I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, so we saved you some time to get right to the good stuff. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. In 10 days, Vermont voters will select the major party candidates for the fall elections. In fact, early voting is already underway for these races. Over the course of the next week, VPR will broadcast three primary campaign debates, starting today with the Republican candidates for governor. Joining us today are incumbent Governor Phil Scott, who is seeking his second term in office, and businessman Keith Stern, who owns and operates Stern's Quality Produce in White River Junction. Great to have you here. Thank you very much for being part of this debate.
Thanks very much for having us on.
Here's the format that we'll be using today and throughout the campaign 2018 debates. In the first segment, I'll ask common questions of both candidates. In the second segment, the candidates will have an opportunity to ask each other questions with a brief follow-up, if you'd like. Then we'll turn to a series of questions that have been submitted by listeners. If we have time, we'll have a lightning round of questions with very brief answers, and we'll conclude our program today with one-minute closing statements from each candidate. So let's start today talking about some education issues, because you both have raised rising property taxes as a major concern in this campaign. Mr. Stern, on town meeting day, the vast majority of Vermont towns gave their approval to their local school budgets. In fact, over 90% of the budgets passed. So it appears that many voters are willing to accept higher property taxes to support their local schools. So if that's the case, why are they wrong? Are you trying to, in a sense, protect taxpayers from themselves?
In essence, yes. Because I don't think they're very educated about where the money is going. I know, for instance, in Springfield, we're very, very administrative heavy in education. People don't see that. We have a curriculum coordinator, and we have somebody underneath them at all four of the schools in town. Now, is that a necessity? Could we do away with that? I believe back when I was in school, the teachers were given their curriculum at the beginning of the year and followed through with it. Our superintendent makes over $100,000 for schools. I think it could be a shared thing, a part-time job, a semi-retired person. There's places to save money.
Currently, about 70% of all Vermont property owners pay their school taxes based on their income and not the value of their property, a program known as income sensitivity. Would you support changing the education financing system so that all Vermonters pay their school taxes based on their income?
I would have to look at that. The first thing I want to do is to make cuts in the spending. I'm looking at $100 million overall for the state. Then we can go back and look at other things. But the priority is just to get the taxes down.
Mr. Scott, same question for you about the decisions that local voters make in terms of supporting their school budgets. Previously, you've said that you don't think voters really understand the consequences of their decisions. Do you not think that when a person votes for a higher school budget in their community, that they don't realize that their taxes will probably increase somewhat?
Well, it is a very complicated system, Bob. As you know, in Berlin, as a matter of fact, in years past, the budget has passed and taxes have gone down. So I don't think there's a direct correlation between voting in favor or not. But when you look back again at this last cycle town meeting day when school budgets were passed, only about 20% of the voters showed up. So I don't believe that's a vast representation of how the electorate feels about this issue. We have an affordability crisis on our hands. We're spending $1.7 billion to educate about 75,000 students, about 30,000 fewer students than 20 years ago. And we're spending, it's the single largest investment single largest expenditure in state government. And that leads, because it's directly tied to our property taxes, that's how we fund it. That's what leads to the higher property taxes. So we need to do something different. This is unsustainable.
You talked about the low turnout on town meeting day. Don't you think people would turn out if they were opposed to rising taxes?
I think people are – the complicated system. Act 60 has made it complicated in some respects. Because what happens is everyone, the districts all pass their budgets and then they send the bills into Montpelier, and Montpelier puts it all in a big pot and determines how much money is it's going to take in order to pay off all the invoices. And then they raise taxes in order to do that. So there's not a sense of individual districts having really all that much control over their own state budget or their own school budgets.
And would you support the legislation at the State House that would shift the financing of education from the property tax over to the income tax?
I've been consistent in saying that I don't mind having a dialogue, a debate about whether we should be changing the education formula. The funding formula. But if we're not going to address the expenditure, the spending, then I would not be in favor of that, because it comes out of a different pocket and it's still the same amount of money. And we're just rearranging the deck chairs, so to speak. So I believe that we need to address the spending side. We can have the debate about whether we should be doing it with another method. And as you mentioned before, income sensitivity, I believe it's about 70% are income sensitized now. So at the same time, we've almost had that situation as we speak. But at the same time, we have to focus on the expenditures, on the spending, because again, this is unsustainable. We're one of the highest per pupil costs in the nation.
Today on the program, we are broadcasting a primary campaign debate with the GOP Republican gubernatorial candidates. With us, incumbent Governor Phil Scott and also businessman Keith Stern. We're discussing education issues. Let's just follow along with that thread, Mr. Stern. At your website, you say the current student-staff ratio of 4.2 is, quote, completely unacceptable. So do you support a state mandate to increase this ratio in the future?
No, I don't believe in state mandates at all. I believe that somebody from my administration will go into the schools and work with them. It can't be a one-size-fits-all system. It doesn't work. But that is the goal, is to get somebody in there to really look at the numbers. And some of the classrooms, some of the kids learn faster. They don't need the individual on hand by the teacher, and some do. So it's going to be different size classrooms for the different students.
So if you don't have a state mandate, how do you ensure that this student-staff ratio actually goes up?
Well, the thing is to go to the schools, find the optimum system, and present it to the school board, present it to the town in town meetings, and let them decide. I mean, ultimately, it's up to the local communities to decide.
I also had a question for you about Act 46, the state school consolidation law. Under that law, the Vermont State Board of Education has the authority to require school mergers even if towns don't support it, the merging of school districts. And then we have a case in central Vermont where it appears that this could happen. Should the state have the power to mandate that these school district mergers take place?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Because it's not up to the state. It's local control.
Well, how can you – are you going to have some smaller schools in Vermont? Do you think there's not –
It's always worked. Why all of a sudden doesn't it work anymore? The school is basically the center of the community in a lot of these places. So what happens when you close the school? What do you have?
Mr. Scott, the same question for you. You've been suggesting higher student-staff ratios as a way to save a lot of money. Initially, you supported a state mandate, then you backed off of that position. How do you achieve this goal if it's not adopted at the local level?
Well, you mentioned Act 46, and one of the goals, one of the missions of Act 46 was actually to raise the student-to-staff ratio. So we all understand this is a problem. We're about 4 to 4.5 to 1 right now. Again, we're spending $1.7 billion to educate these 75,000 kids, which works out to about 22,000 per student. And that's one of the highest across the nation. So if we were to go, we could magically go from 4.5 to 5.5 to 1. And by the way, we're the lowest in the nation at 4 to 1 or 4.5 to 1. If we could go to 5.5 to 1, we'd save $100 million right there. And we were in years past, 30 years ago, about 6 or 7 to 1. So it can be accomplished, but there has to be incentives in order to do it. But the way the mechanism now with Act 60, everyone pays in and then it's distributed across the state. So we're all paying into the system, so to speak. And so there's no direct correlation between your school and your staff to student ratios. Some do it better than others.
What about Act 46? You mentioned that. What about the provision that does allow the State Board of Education to mandate school district mergers, even when the towns oppose such a merger? As I mentioned, this is a big issue in central Vermont right now, where the towns do not want to have that merger, and they're afraid that the State Board is going to say, you have to do it. Do you support that aspect of the law?
Well, again, with the Supreme Court decision a long time ago in Act 60. We've lost a lot of local control in a lot of respects. And Act 46 was in place long before I took office. So we're following through on that and providing as much support and help to the schools to make sure that they make the best decisions for our kids. And we can't forget about that. When we have some of these small schools like Rochester, for instance, they got to a point where they had two in their senior class, two students, and then they decided to close down the school and merge with somebody else. I would say that it should have happened long before that, because when you think about the student, are they getting the best education possible with only two students? What about sports? What about music? What about the arts? What about languages? I would venture to say that they don't get the same quality of education as those who have higher student-to-staff ratios. So we're going to have to do – it's uncomfortable. Nobody wants to close down their small schools. That's been consistently the case over the years. But we need to grow the population. We need to do something different because it really is unsustainable as we're moving forward now.
So on the question of whether or not you support that mandate, that part of Act 46, your answer would be yes.
I would say yes, qualified with I'd rather have it an incentive. There be a carrot instead of a stick.
Let's talk about guns. Mr. Stern, it looks like you want to add something, but
yeah.
We're going to have to wait until you have your opportunity to ask questions of Phil Scott to do that.
Well, it wasn't a question for him. I just want to say under Act 46 – what I'm hearing is administration costs aren't being cut, which is ridiculous. That was supposed to be the point of it. And I've heard from different places where kids are on a bus 2 hours each direction. Unacceptable.
Let's talk about guns. Mr. Stern, Governor Scott signed a bill this year that expands background checks. It raises the age to buy a gun from 18 to 21 unless the person takes an approved gun safety course. It bans large magazines. It also bans the sale of bump stocks. You've suggested that if you're elected governor, you would not enforce this law because you think it's unconstitutional. So could you explain to our listeners which parts of this law are unconstitutional?
Well, first of all, it's been ruled in California that magazine restrictions are unconstitutional. Ohio just ruled that bump stock ban is unconstitutional. And anytime you infringe on anybody's rights to buy a weapon, which is raising the age, that is unconstitutional.
Although there is a provision in the law that allows 18-year-olds to buy a gun if they take a gun safety course.
They have to do that.
And what are your thoughts about the law that allows police officers to temporarily take a gun away from someone that a judge determines is a danger to themselves or the public at large?
If it goes through due process, that's the key. It's got to be due process.
Mr. Scott, What do you say to those Vermonters who feel that you have completely betrayed them by changing your position on this gun legislation? And they wonder, if they can't trust you on this issue, then how can they trust you on other important issues? So how can they?
Yeah, I completely understand their anger and their disappointment. Obviously, I live it on a day-to-day basis. And I went into this with my eyes wide open. When I took the position and I swore my oath to Vermont and took the position as governor, I accepted a lot of responsibility, one of them being public safety and it being the highest priority of any government. And I believe that puts an incredible amount of burden on your shoulders to do the right thing for the citizens of Vermont. I've said consistently over the years, and I haven't backed away from this. And I would say to anyone, I'm not trying to sugarcoat this. I've said over the years that I didn't believe that we had a problem in Vermont, that we were somehow different, that we shouldn't change our gun laws. But after Parkland, and almost simultaneous to that, and eerily similar, we had an event in Fairhaven. And I believe that at that point, after reading the affidavit, that we needed to do something different. And I was open to the discussion about having gun safety measures discussed.
So critics of the bill also argue that there's really nothing in the legislation that would have prevented a mass school shooting like the one that was allegedly planned for Fairhaven Union High School. So what have you really achieved with this bill?
Well, the extreme risk order is one that is implemented right now for that young man, that individual. And I would say that there were other provisions as well. He was able to buy a gun at 18 without any safety course of any sort. I would also say, I know Keith had mentioned that California has reversed its position in the Supreme Court, and that's just not the case. What they did was they went to intercede and stop the question from being considered, and that wasn't well taken. So that case is still yet to be determined in California, but there have been other cases throughout the country in terms of Supreme Court decisions where bump stocks and magazine bans have been upheld.
Mr. Scott, in a recent VPR Vermont PBS poll, people were asked if they support the job that President Trump is doing. 28% said yes, 61% said no, 10% were not sure. How would you answer that question? And does President Trump, in your mind, represent the future of the Republican Party?
Well, I don't think any one person represents one party whatsoever. Certainly, it's been well documented that I don't agree with the president on every issue. I think he's done some good things, but it's just the way he carries himself and his approach, I think, his style that I don't adhere to. And I think we need better role models in this country and throughout the world. And I don't believe that he's leading by example, as he should. You need somebody you can look up to and respect and treat people with respect and civility. Having said that, so the income tax proposal, the federal tax package, I think has had a beneficial effect on the nation and Vermont. I am concerned about the debt that it adds. That was my only caveat in some respects from supporting. I just don't lie. I'm adverse to debt myself. So, I would put myself in the category as yes and no, yet to be seen. But I don't think he has to represent – he doesn't represent the party. I've been a Republican longer than he has.
What concerns you the most about his style of governance?
It's just the way he does things by Twitter, for instance. I think words matter. I think you have to choose your words carefully. And you have to deliberate. And I think he does things by Twitter and by emotion and doesn't completely think things through and determine what effect that could have. It's this polarization we're seeing across our country from both extremes, the extreme left, the extreme right, and those of us who are in the middle, the moderates of the world. It leaves little room for us because social media has played into that. It divides our country. And what I'm looking for is a leader to unite us, not divide us. And we need that more than ever, as far as I'm concerned.
Mr. Stern, how would you answer that question that we have on the poll? Do you support the job that President Trump is doing?
I agree with some of the things, and I disagree with the other with others. I can't say, I would say 100%. Maybe it's closer to 50%. But I appreciate the job he's doing and how hard a job it is.
Do you think he's taking the Republican Party in the right direction?
I don't know if anybody's taking the Republican Party in the right direction. It's become so dysfunctional at this point. We have the rhinos in there along with conservatives, and it's just there doesn't seem to be any compromise or consensus.
So what concerns you the most? You said it's kind of 50-50. Let's look at the 50% side that you have some concerns about. What concerns you about the Trump administration?
I am concerned with the tariffs. It might work out. In the short term, it doesn't seem like a very good idea. That would probably be the biggest issue. I don't know where that's going to go. I hope it works out, like I said, but I don't know. That would be the biggest. One thing that bothers me is his antagonistic approach to opponents.
The candidates will now have an opportunity to ask each other questions. The questions should not be longer than 30 seconds. We're not looking at speeches. We're looking at brief questions. The responses are limited to 60 seconds. And a brief follow-up question will be allowed if a candidate wants to ask it. So, with that, Mr. Stern, what is your first question for Mr. Scott?
Okay. As governor, you signed gun laws, resurrected the individual mandate, legalized marijuana, enacted sanctuary-like policies, approved federally prohibited importation of prescription drugs from Canada, and took out a $35 million housing bond that Vermonters will need to pay for. These are policies straight from the DNC platform. Why aren't you running as a Democrat?
Well, I've been a Republican longer than you have, Keith, as a matter of fact, and I've always adhered to the fiscal values that the Republican Party holds. I believe I'm more of a George Aiken type of Republican, someone who is in tune to the people. I don't apologize for being a fiscal conservative. But at the same time, I'm a social moderate, and I believe in moderation. I believe in getting along with others. I believe in trying to work with the cards you're dealt. And I've been, again, involved in politics now for about 18 years in the state Senate for five terms and lieutenant governor for three terms and two terms – or one term as governor, hopefully another term. And I've always tried to treat others with respect and civility and trying to do what I think is right for Vermonters, not what somebody tells me to do, not what the polls say to do, but what's right and let the chips fall where they may. And I've done that throughout my entire career.
Would you like to have a follow-up question?
Okay. So on gun laws and the individual mandate, would you say those are Republican stances at all?
I think you'll find as you go out throughout the state, and I've been a gun owner my entire life. I took my NRA course when I was 12. I have a gun safe full of guns. I've been a hunter my whole life, and I have a lot of friends that hunt and fish and are sportsmen and are avid shooters. And I would say that it's divided. I think that some of the – after I can explain what was before me, what I had to determine and do some soul searching myself, they understand. And some of them actually agree with me. And I think there are more people out there that agree with me than you think. And we'll find out. But at the same time, I know I disappointed and angered a lot of people. I accept that. And I had my eyes wide open, and I'll be prepared for the consequences.
Mr. Scott, your first question for Mr. Stern.
Well, Keith, you've had an interesting career in politics. In fact, a year ago, you said after much soul searching, you were going to run as a Democrat. You also said, I just thought that the Democrats have the best opportunity to get things done. And in 2004, you said you were going to vote for John Kerry. or even Ralph Nader. So my question is, why did you change your mind and why did you all of a sudden decide to become a Republican?
I never said I would vote for John Kerry.
Well, I have that in quotes, but go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know where you got that from, but I have never said John Kerry because I've always opposed him. But Ralph Nader was the best candidate at the time because he looks at all the issues and makes informed consent. He's not a Democrat. He's just somebody that really looks at the ideas and has the best ideas. Well, now he's gone more to the extreme left, but at the time he was definitely more middle of the road as far as his issues. And I never said I was going to run as a Democrat. I considered it. I stated on VPR that I was considering doing it because I wanted to help bring the Democrats more to the center, and I saw that was never going to happen.
Again, I'm just using quotes that I pulled and you did say it. So, and I wouldn't consider Ralph Nader being a moderate of any sort. In fact, he took the Corvair away from us. So,
well, we know how dangerous that car was until he started in on that.
I think the Corvair owners of the world would disagree.
Mr. Stern, your second question for Mr. Scott.
Okay, this May, you enacted a statewide individual health insurance mandate, which was recently eliminated by Congress. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the individual mandate is a tax. Why did you sign this new health tax when you pledged no new taxes?
Well, first of all, I didn't. The individual mandate wasn't my initiative. It was long before me, and you're right. The federal government did take it away. Nobody has instituted that at this point in time. The legislature passed legislation to study it once again, but it's not something that I believe. I'm not looking to make insurance more expensive, but I am want to be sure that people have health care when they need it and at a price they can afford. So this is complicated. Health care is really complicated in across the country and in Vermont. We're trying to do what we can in terms of making it more affordable, but I'm not looking to force people to pay a penalty on something that they can't afford. So this is a study. It wasn't implemented. It was a study that the legislature put forward.
Well, it is forcing people to do it, and how will it make health insurance more affordable? You talked about making
I haven't signed anything that puts an individual mandate into place.
Well, it's been signed by you.
It was a study on the individual mandate as whether we should be moving forward with that again, and circumventing the federal response. But I believe that we should be looking at other ways of making insurance more affordable. The federal changes that are being enacted at this point in time precludes us from doing a lot of what we need to do. We need to protect access to affordable health care. I believe that we have this – we're utilize a pilot program for the all-payer model, and I think this program has been successful thus far. We did it with a limited 30,000 member pool. I'd like to expand it a bit now because I believe that paying instead of fee for service, paying for the health care, the overall holistic health of the person would pay a big dividends. And we have to, you know, substance abuse and so forth. So we have a lot to do with in health care. We have a lot to be proud of, but again, we need to grow the population and grow the economy in order for us to pay for it.
So, Mr. Scott, your second question for Mr. Stern.
Keith, I know, believe me, after holding office now in many different areas over the years, I know how difficult it is to put yourself out there and run for any office. So I applaud you for stepping forward. I know how difficult it is. But if you're serious about running for office, why haven't you submitted the appropriate paperwork that's required that all of us have to do I don't like submitting my tax returns and letting the world see everything about me and having my business that I owned before be put out in the limelight. But why haven't you submitted all the required paperwork at this time?
Because under the law, people have the right to privacy with their 1040s. The other form I did, the financial disclosure, I filed. But my wife is very private.
As is mine.
She's not running for office, and she said she doesn't want her information shown. And I respect her. Am I going to say, too bad for you? You're going to have to release it? I would drop out before I forced her to show her personal information.
Well, again, I know how difficult it is, but the rest of us have had to do it. And I just think it's unfair that you could just pick and choose and determine how you're going to do it.
Well, we've signed gun legislation that's unconstitutional.
Well, we'll see. We'll see about that. I mean, and we'll live with the consequences, whatever that is. Well, the Supreme Court rules on that. I'll live with that.
Is that the way it should work, though? You wait, pass a law, and wait and see if it's constitutional?
Well, I believe that what we did was constitutional. I don't believe that we're taking anyone's Second Amendment rights away. I'm still a believer in the Second Amendment. Again, a gun owner myself, gun safe full of guns, and I believe that everyone has the right to protect themselves and own guns, and nothing in the laws that we pass precludes anybody from doing that.
Well, you're not talking about Article 16, too.
Yeah, I would include Article 16 as well.
Today in the program, we have the two candidates seeking the GOP gubernatorial nomination, businessman Keith Stern, also incumbent Phil Scott. Mr. Stern, what's your third and final question for Mr. Scott?
Okay, let's talk about Act 46. It consolidates school districts, grows the state's top-down central planning education bureaucracy while eliminating individual choice. You have said you don't want to repeal Act 46 because it would be unfair to the administrators. Do you believe losing school choice is fair to the children of Vermont?
No, I think there is a better system out there. We should have a system, an education system in there, out there that is conducive to growth and that focuses on our kids. But the fact is, because of our demographics, our education system is increasingly inefficient in diverting those resources from the kids that we're trying to protect. This isn't the teachers or the staff's fault. It's just all our faults for not acknowledging the demographics, the role demographics have played over the last number of years. We're the second oldest state in the nation. We lost population last year. Our demographics are getting older. We're losing kids out of our schools. We have to consider doing something different. Act 46 isn't perfect. It wasn't something that I would have done myself, but it was a law that was passed and has been moving forward, and we need to consider following through with that. And again, we need to grow our population, bring people, make Vermont more affordable, attract more businesses, more people to the state, and bring more kids into our schools and go back to what we had and bring more people in and educate more students. But we have to do it in a 21st century way and an interactive way as well.
Mr. Scott, your third question for Mr. Stern.
You know, there's been some questions, Keith, in terms of your support for the National Guard, and I don't have all the details of that. But I'm curious, because I just don't know, what's your feelings about the F-35?
I believe that there has to be sacrifices made for freedom, and it's a small sacrifice compared to what the military people and their family are putting up with. I'd probably be grousing if they were flying over my house too, but I would sure be appreciative if they ever needed to be called into action to protect our country. So that is my stand.
I've been a staunch supporter of the F-35 since its inception. I even went to Washington to confer with the Secretary of the Air Force to beg her to make sure that we continue to do that. But there's an example, Keith, of forcing something onto someone else without their input. And I would say that they probably would feel the same way as maybe you do on some of the other issues you brought up. But I'm still thank you very much for being a supporter of the F-35. Yes. It's important.
But would it be forced upon somebody somewhere?
Again, it's great that you're a supporter because this is something that's great for our economy, and we need to rely on it and for our military families as well. So I appreciate that.
We're going to turn now to some questions from our listeners. And I just want to mention we've gotten lots of questions from our listeners. I want to thank folks for sending these questions in. They're really good. I wish we could get to all of them, but we'll try to get to as many as possible. We got this from Sally. What is your position on the role of large-scale wind as part of Vermont's energy future? Mr. Scott?
I've been in opposition in the last election. I'm very proud of the fact that we have appeared to have stopped the development of our ridgelines with old, outdated wind energy. We have other alternatives. If it was the last approach we could take, I might feel differently, but we have other options. We have solar, which has proven to be very effective and has gained in efficiency. So I'm opposed to large-scale wind development on our ridgelines.
Mr. Stern.
I agree. That's not the place for wind-powered knocking down the tops of our mountains. In the ocean, that seems to make sense there. And I know they're using that effectively, but it doesn't make sense for Vermont.
We got this email from Kent Henderson, who is the chair of Friends of Northern Lake Champlain. Vermont has promised in a memo of understanding with the EPA to designate a long-term funding source to clean up Lake Champlain and its basin. Right now, Vermont is using money for 2 years to clean up the lake. Where will you find the $25 million per year to fulfill Vermont's promise to the EPA for the remaining 18 years? Mr. Stern?
Well, first of all, I'm looking at $100 million in cut in spending from cutting the waste in the government. So we will have more money for that. Second of all, the priority has to be stopping the pollution. Then cleanup is a lot less expensive and a lot quicker. And that's what we have to focus on.
Would you identify a long-term funding source?
Well, it's going to be through taxes, through the savings that we're going to come up with.
All right. Mr. Scott?
Well, Keith, the good news is you don't have to wait for those savings because we've already implemented a lot of those efficiencies in state government and saved a lot of money, almost $100 million in the Agency of Human Services alone. So we've led to record surpluses of late. I do believe there will be some surpluses in the future, and I believe that there's a source within state government now. I'm committed to improving water quality, and we've committed to a record level of funding over the next few years. And I believe that we have another source and I'll identify that if I'm elected in the next the general election to move forward with a proposal that I believe we can use existing resources to fund water quality.
So you have a source of funding?
I have one that I'm contemplating, and we'll see what happens.
Why don't you share it with us?
Well, it's premature. I will watch the way the surpluses hopefully continue to come in. Again, we had a record amount of surpluses, something we haven't seen for a decade or two. And I believe that we can use a source from within. So I'm confident of that.
We got this from Amy. Vermont ranks last in public support for higher education. Employers increasingly point to the lack of skilled workforce, and state officials continue to note the exodus of skilled working-age people. How will we pay for increased higher education funding? Mr. Scott, isn't this question a key to the state's whole demographic challenge?
Well, part of it is, and it's something that I've identified. Again, we're spending about $1.7 billion to educate about 75,000 students. I believe we're spending enough money within the education system now, but we're doing so inefficiently. What we should be looking at is a cradle-to-career type of curriculum where we can utilize the 1.7 and invest in more early care and learning and invest more in higher education, trades training, because, again, that's part of our answer. We need more of that trades training in particular. Because the average age of a construction worker is about 56. Next time you look at an electrician or plumber, you'll know what I mean. We need to bring more people in and be more attractive. But I believe we're spending enough money within the system. We need to broaden it out and spend more in those other areas.
Mr. Stern, you've talked about the need to cut the budget. You just mentioned cutting the budget by $100 million.
Not to start.
Would you support increased spending on higher education in Vermont?
I don't know if that is really the issue. It's why is education cost growing at a much faster rate than the rate of inflation? That's what has to be looked at first. Find out why it's growing so fast, why it's so expensive.
Could you see yourself supporting additional funding for higher ed?
If it's necessary, absolutely.
We got this from Alice. With constant news stories on catastrophic fires, floods, and hurricanes, what ideas do you have on how to reverse the effects of climate change, and what's your timetable for doing so? Mr. Stern, talk to us about climate change.
I think it's a natural occurring thing. From everything I've heard, read from real experts, it's not man-made. It's just a natural occurring thing. This used to be a glacier here. It will change, and it will continue to change. That's not to say we don't have to look at becoming smarter about conserving electricity and looking for new sources that doesn't have the pollution.
So you don't think there's a link between pollution on Earth and climate change?
I don't.
Okay. Mr. Scott?
Climate change is real. We have a goal in this state of 90% renewables by 2050. I believe that's attainable, and I believe that we're going to do so through technology. We have seen where we made steps, leaps and bounds in terms of what we can do to better conserve and better to prevent carbon emissions. About half of it is in transportation. That's why we're using Volkswagen money right now to create a better infrastructure for charging from our borders, particularly because we want to accept more tourism from and more trade from those in Canada. But that's part of the answer, trying to do everything we can to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels.
In that VPR Vermont PBS poll that I mentioned earlier in the program, 47% of people said that either they or someone they know have been personally affected by opiate addiction. It was the second most important issue that people listed right behind the economy, jobs, and the cost of living. Is the state doing enough to provide treatment programs for all the people who need it? And is a new, more comprehensive approach needed to deal with this very important issue? Mr. Stern?
Oh, we're not doing anywhere near enough. First of all, we're not prosecuting these people and sentencing, giving them realistic sentencing. That's the first step, because you cut the head off a snake, it's going to stop. And that's what we have to do. And then we've got to provide more treatment centers. But one of the things I talk about is people on government assistance giving back by doing community service and running school programs, after school programs, weekend programs for kids where they're applicable, tough word. And you keep kids busy, occupied, happy, they're not going to be so apt to be doing drugs and alcohol abuse.
Mr. Scott.
Well, this crisis is real, and for those who don't think it affects them are probably just oblivious to that. In my first 2 years, I'm very proud of what we've done. We've established the Opioid Coordination Council. People from all walks of life are part of the council, a director of drug abuse prevention. We're now providing treatment pretty much on demand, which means when someone is ready for treatment, they can get it. There was long wait lists before, 700 in Chittenden County alone. That's down to zero. We put in place job placement services for those in recovery, and we've increased law enforcement actions on dealers. But this isn't over. We can do more, and we should do more to prevent substance abuse and support those in recovery as well.
Mr. Cerna, I just wanted to clarify, you talked about penalties. You were dealing with and talking about people who sell drugs?
Yes. First-time offenders, nonviolent offenders, reopening Windsor County prison farm, putting them in there to do a work education program.
Okay. Very quick answer to this one. We got this from a number of people. Do you support a plan to provide all Vermonters with health care that would be financed through a progressive tax system, basically a single-payer system or Medicare for all, as it's also known? And do you view health care as a right and not a privilege? Briefly, Mr. Stern, your thoughts on that.
I don't support taxpayer-funded. I think we can do it without that way. I'm looking at a health share program that the prices are extremely lower than what we have now from the commercial insurance. They call MVP and Blue Cross Blue Shield nonprofit, but who are we kidding, really? This will reduce the price, and my system, with other changes to working with healthcare providers, we can reduce the cost even more.
Briefly, Mr. Scott.
Well, again, I've seen where Keith has supported a single-payer system in the past, so I'm surprised by his answer. But I do not support. We've seen this single-payer system. We've seen this movie. Governor Shumlin tried to enact this over a period of 6 years and finally came to the conclusion that Vermont could not afford it. So I'm continuing to find other ways to model this so we can provide health care at a cost that people can afford in Vermont and not make us uncompetitive with the rest of the world.
I do have to say one thing. I still talk about single payer, but not government run. We can do it without it being government run, which would be a lot more efficient and a lot less expensive.
All right. Now time for a closing statement from each candidate. Mr. Stern, start us off.
Fellow Republicans, conservatives, and constitutionalists, the governor has given us a gift. By signing unconstitutional gun laws and the individual mandate, he has energized our base. There is more motivation to vote for change than there has been in a very long time. We must seize on this opportunity. I am running to give a voice to the forsaken, to represent us who feel betrayed by a governor who consistently takes us Republicans for granted. I am running to protect our unique Vermont rights and freedoms and to uphold the laws of this great state and the nation. I will return the power to the people. I look forward to your vote on August 14th. Thank you very much.
Mr. Scott.
Well, thank you, Bob, for moderating and VPR for hosting this debate. Over the last 2 years, I've fought for fiscal responsibility to make Vermont more affordable and grow our economy. And we're making real and measurable progress. We passed two general fund budgets without any new taxes or fees. We've cut income tax rates by $30 million this year alone, and we've eliminated the tax on Social Security for many Vermonters. And we also prevented $71 million in property tax rate increases. We made the largest investment in workforce housing Vermont has ever seen, and we provided tuition-free college for National Guard members. We're doing the hard work, but making Vermont more affordable can't happen overnight, and that's why I'm asking for your support in continuing this fight as we head into the August 14th primary. So I thank you very much. I hope the voters will give me the opportunity to serve again as Vermont's governor.
This concludes the VPR Republican Governor's Debate on Vermont Edition. Many thanks to the candidates for being part of our program today. We really appreciate it. I'm Bob Kinzel. Thanks for listening.